follow geodesics in space-time, then we could recover the Newtonian description of gravity by at least for weak gravitational fields. And this weak means that g mu nu is eta mu nu plus h mu nu, with h mu nu much less than 1. Okay, so weak means that there is a coordinate system in which g is given by eta with a small correction. And for weak gravitational fields, which are static, and that just means d by dt of g mu nu equals 0, then we could identify g naught naught with that expression where phi is the gravitational potential. Okay, so we reproduced with this formula, we reproduce d2x dt squared equals minus grad phi, which is what Newton would have told you for the acceleration of a particle in a gravitational field. Okay, so the geodesic equation reproduced this. Now, in Newton's theory of gravity, this phi is the gravitational potential. So obviously, it's determined by the distribution of mass. What equation determines phi from the distribution of mass? Anybody remember from Newton's theory? So obviously, the force is gm squared over r squared. The potential you get by summing gm over r. But you can write a simple formula for phi in terms of the density of matter, rho. Anybody remember what it is? What? Oh, who is that? What did you say? Poisson equation. Okay, so Poisson equation is del squared phi equals 4 pi g rho. And this means the mass density. Okay, so I put rho sub m, because often I use rho for the energy density. Rho sub m is the mass density. It's the density of mass per unit volume. So is everybody familiar with that equation and where it comes from? Yes or no? No. Good. So how do you derive the Poisson equation? Well, the Poisson equation is equivalent to the statement that the Newtonian potential is equal to some, if I have particles, if I think of a bunch of particles, the Newtonian potential is equal to some of these particles, 1 up to n, minus gmi over r. Modulus r minus ri. Let's call it A so we don't get confused with coordinates. Okay? So you're familiar with this equation, right? When we consider the gravitational potential, it's just the sum, you use superposition, you add up the gravitational potentials due to all the point masses, right? And the gravitational potential, let me just write this out again. Phi at the location r, okay, in space, is the sum, A equals 1 to n, right, due to n particles, is minus gma over the modulus r minus ra. Is everyone happy with that? Newtonian, the gravitational potential is just minus gm over r, where r is the distance from u to the mass. V You've got many particles, you just add it all up. Okay? So why is this equivalent to that? Because for n particles, right, rho of r is equal to what? If I have n point particles of mass ma, what is the density corresponding to a bunch of point particles? You did this for the homework, more or less. Something like it. Pardon? Sum of deltas, yeah? So this rho of r is the sum of a, ma, delta, r minus ra. Okay, so just think of that as the density, the mass density due to point particles, is a sum of delta functions. And why is that true? Well, obviously, if I integrate the mass density in some region containing one of those delta functions, I get a 1. And that just tells me the mass associated with that region is ma. Okay? So that's the density of a collection of point particles. And the second thing you need to know is that this equation has a Green's function. Well, if I put this onto the right-hand side of that equation, I have to solve it. So I have to solve this solution. Del squared phi A is equal to this, is equal to, let's just do one particle. Do you know what the solution of that equation is? I can put a 4 pi in there. Solution of that equation is just 1 over r minus ra, right? Because you have the del squared of 1 over r minus ra equals minus 4 pi delta 3 r minus ra. Is that a familiar formula or not? Not? No. Okay, let's derive this formula. Have you done the idea of a Green's function in math? Green's function. What's a Green's function? Got some differential equation. What's the Green's function mean? That's, yeah, there's, okay, so let's imagine I have some equation like this. Just an ODE, okay? Equal to, well, I don't know, do I want to go back this far? Let me stick to space. That's a Green's function in time for ODEs, but if I do a Green's function in space. The Green's function, by definition, let me do this. Let's just do the Green's function for the Laplace equation. The Green's function is a function of r and r prime. That's the Laplacian squared for r. Okay, so this thing here is d2 by dx squared plus d2. dy squared plus d2 dz squared. And then the Green's function, by definition, is the solution of this equation. Okay, so Green's function, by definition, is the solution of an equation with a delta function source. If the equation is linear, I can use the, so this also gives me the solution of the equation. Let's say I put some other source in the equation. Let's call it JR. Say I'm trying to solve this equation, right? It's a linear equation. in S with some source J. So this operator, Laplacian on S, is some source. How do I solve it? Well, if I know the Green's function solution, then the solution is just given by integral d3r prime gr r prime j of r prime. Okay? And that should be clear, because if I just substitute, so it's an integral of the source times the Green's function. So all this is doing is basically adding up, is writing the source as a bunch of delta functions across space, and then adding up the solution for all of them. So to check it's a solution, just plug this into there. Del r squared comes under the integral, acts on the r here, gives you a delta function through this equation, and then the integral of a delta function gives you J of r. Okay? So this is a general technique of writing down the solution of linear partial differential equations. If you can find the Green's function, then you know the then it's easy to solve for any source. Okay, this is the source. This is called the source. Okay, so that's exactly what we've got here. We've got a source, which is a sum of delta functions, and I want to find phi. To show that this is the right Green's function, there are two steps. Okay, first of all, solve it for r not equal to ra. Okay, how do I solve? So if r is not equal to ra, this is 0. Okay, so I just want to solve this equation, del squared, this one. I want to solve del squared g of r prime equals 0, r not equal to r prime. Okay, to solve it, what we do is just look at this so we've got some delta function source, and I want to solve the equation outside that delta function source. Now, this is spherically symmetric, a delta function, right? Delta function doesn't matter which angle I'm at around the source. And so to solve it, we look for a spherically symmetric solution. This is r equals ra. And let's just change coordinates to r twiddle equal to r minus ra, so that the source is at the origin. And then I write this equation down. I get d2 by dr squared plus 2 over r, so Laplacian in spherical polar coordinates, d by dr of g equals 0. This is of r twiddle now. Equals 0. General solution of this equation is g goes like a power, r to the n. This gives me n minus 1 plus 2n equals 0. So n plus 1 equals 0. So n equals 0 or minus 1. Okay, so g is equal to constant over r plus some other constant. And so the general solution of this equation outside the delta function is 1 over r with some constant. And then to fix the constant, what you use is the divergence theorem. So we would like g to go to 0 as r goes to infinity. And so that fixes d equals 0. To fix c, what we do is integrate both sides of this equation. We integrate both sides of the equation on a little ball centered on r equals ra. OK, so integral d3r, a ball centered on RA. And the left-hand side, I'm going to use the divergence theorem. So integral del squared. Sorry, I keep referring to this equation. I'm solving this equation. Del squared g, this is equal to integral grad g ds over the surface of the ball. So g is 1 over r, grad g is 1 over r squared. This is 4 pi with a minus sign, because differentiating 1 over r gives you a minus sign. So it's minus 4 pi over r squared times r squared. The surface is 4 pi r squared. And so this gives us minus 4 pi times c. And the right-hand side, I just get 1. And so c is minus 1 over 4 pi. OK, so the Green's function for the Laplace equation is just minus 1 over 4 pi r minus ra. OK, so if you're not, if you haven't seen that before, then I do encourage you to read about it. It's a very important mathematical technique using these Green's functions. And maybe if you want to go through that in the tutorial, you can do that. Okay, so Poisson wrote down this equation, which is entirely equivalent to Newton's gravitational potential formula for individual masses. And so these two equations describe Newtonian gravity, that the mass density of matter, okay, like the sun or the earth or stars or whatever, determines the gravitational potential from this equation. And that gravitational potential determines the acceleration of any particles. Okay, so for example, to work out how the Earth goes around the sun, you take this to be the density of the sun, you work out the gravitational potential around the sun from this equation, and then you solve the geodesic equation for the Earth going around the sun. Okay, that would be the calculation where you neglect the gravity due to the Earth as compared to the gravity due to the sun. Okay. If you think about relativity, what is unsatisfying about this theory? Okay, Poisson's equation is telling you how some density of matter determines the gravitational potential. What is a bit worrying about it from the point of view of relativity? Remember, relativity implies that signals can't go faster than the speed of light. So what made Einstein unhappy about this theory? Yeah? Absolutely, absolutely. So you see, the solution I just derived for this, this solution here, let's just write it out. So phi is equal to minus integral d3r prime g rho of r prime over modulus r minus r prime. That's phi at the position r. Okay. Now, according to Laplace, that is true even if I made the density time dependent. Okay, because this equation is true even if rho depends on time. So what it's saying is that if I have a mass, okay, and I move it, the gravitational potential at arbitrary large distance will change instantaneously. Okay, so this mass has a potential 1 over r. I move it over here. Instantly, the potential will change everywhere in space to 1 over r minus the new coordinate for the particle. OK? Okay, so you can communicate faster than the speed of light just by moving masses around. And somebody else measures the gravitational field. So Einstein realized this is completely incompatible with the notion of relativity. You cannot do this in electromagnetism, right? In electromagnetism, if I move a charged particle, its electromagnetic field propagates outwards at the speed of light, according to Maxwell's equations. And this is not the solution of the electrostatic potential. In electromagnetism, we get something called a retarded Green's function, right? There's something called the Leonard-Wishart potentials. And basically what that says is if I have a charged particle with an electric field like that, and I move it, then near the particle, it will still look like this. But the electric field actually changes on a surface. Sorry, not drawing that very well. Take a charged particle, right? Move it to the left, suddenly, okay? So the old position was here. Then the near field of this charged particle is still spherically symmetric around the particle. Distance is less than the speed of light times the time. It looks like this. The far field still thinks it's centered on this guy. I've drawn it a little bit too extreme. It hasn't moved faster than the speed of light, so it's still... Okay, the particle is here. This is the new position. So the electric field will be centered on the new position, like this. But the distant electric field is centered on the old position. So it'll actually look like this. Okay? And that's really what the electric field looks like if you accelerate a charged particle. It has this kink at a distance r equals, determined by the speed of light times the time. Okay. If you want to see a description of this, there's a beautiful description in Purcell's book on electromagnetism. There's a detailed description about exactly what the electric field looks like for a moved particle. Yep.
The field lights are still continuous, right?
They are. So this picture is true in the approximation that the acceleration is sudden. Okay, so they actually, the field lines connect like this. Okay, so, but what is absolutely correct about this picture is that the field at a distance r bigger than ct from the particle is completely unchanged. I move the particle, the field doesn't know. It's got to wait for the speed of light to propagate out, and then suddenly it changes. Okay, so this was known, again, by Einstein, that electromagnetism does not go faster than the speed of light. You move a particle, and its field takes time to change. Whereas Poisson doesn't do that. So this cannot be right, okay? This is incompatible with relativity. There's another obvious way in which it can't be right. You know, del squares is not invariant under Lorentz transformations. It's connected. There should be a d2 by dt squared minus del squared. That's a Lorentz invariant operator. So Einstein knew this was wrong, and this is the error at the end of Minkowski's paper. So I handed out Minkowski's paper last week, and if you look at the end of it, you'll see a discussion of this, and he says, oh, there's no problem making Newton's theory relativistic. But that's because he didn't understand Newton's theory. Okay, so that was the motivation. That was one of the motivations. Einstein realized this equation cannot be right. You can't, if you believe in relativity, you cannot communicate faster than the speed of light. This equation allows you to do that, so it can't be right. So let us try to write down, using all this machinery from GR, let's try to write down a general relativistic or coordinate invariant version of Newton's equation. So we're already halfway there, because from here, let's call it a generally covariant equation, and all that means is a tensor equation. Okay, an equation which is invariant under coordinate transformations. So generally covariant equation for gravity must reduce to this equation for weak fields and static fields. Okay, so it must reduce. So I just plug in for phi. So del squared phi is obviously del squared G naught naught. So it must reduce to del squared G naught naught equals minus 8 pi G rho mass over C squared. For weak static fields. Okay, so we're sort of halfway there to this general, to this tensor equation for gravity. Now that's equal to minus 8 pi g rho over c to the fourth. Because rho, the energy density, is equal to the mass density times c squared. That's just E equals mc squared. But T naught naught is equal to the energy density. So we're led to this equation that del squared G naught naught is equal to minus 8 pi G over C to the fourth T naught naught for weak static fields. Okay, so that's already looking almost like a tensor equation, because we've got G naught naught and T naught naught. But the del squared is a problem. That's not invariant under coordinate transformations. So that's the equation we're looking for, is one that will reduce to that formula. So obviously, we're going to guess that on the right-hand side here, I must have a tensor. Sorry, on the right-hand side here, I'm going to have the stress-energy tensor. That's the natural guess, T alpha beta. On the left-hand side, I must have some tensor, which is a two-index symmetric tensor to agree with the right-hand side. And it's got to involve two derivatives of the metric. So what could it be? In fact, what is the only tensor you can make which involves two derivatives of the metric? Remember, the only way to get a symmetric tensor out of the Riemann tensor, in fact, the only way to contract the Riemann tensor was to contract the first and the third index. Right? First and second index gave me zero. First and fourth index is equivalent to this. So that's the only way to contract the Riemann tensor. The Riemann tensor is the only tensor you can make out of second derivatives of the metric. And this is the Ricci tensor. Okay. So, so Einstein's original guess was R mu nu equals minus 8 pi g over c, c to the fourth, actually plus times t mu nu. In fact, let me just put a constant here. It's not quite the right constant. But this is inconsistent. Can you tell me why it's inconsistent? Yeah. Energy conservation. You see, in fact, this is entirely analogous to Maxwell's equations. So before Maxwell, people wrote down these equations, but without the last you have this curl B equals J plus dE dt. And so before Maxwell, nobody knew about that term. And what Maxwell showed is that without that term, the equation is inconsistent. Okay, so it's a very simple mathematical argument that says that term better be there, otherwise equations don't mean anything. It's just the same thing. Einstein guessed this term. And he discovered, and the reason for this is actually current conservation. The reason why that term has to be there is because electric current is conserved. The reason why that this has to be corrected is because energy is conserved. Okay, so we have that the covariant derivative of T mu nu equals zero. That's the equation for stress energy conservation. So this is covariant stress energy conservation. Okay? So if you don't have this equation, you don't have local energy conservation, right? Remember, the whole idea is that the laws of physics in the vicinity of some point should just be the normal laws of physics without gravity. So there must be some equation which reduces to this equation, special relativistic energy conservation, in the vicinity of every point. Okay? And there's only one way to make a tensor version of this equation, invariant under all coordinate transformations, and that's this one. So unfortunately, so the right-hand side, so if I write down, you see, if it's a tensor equation, I can raise and lower indices for sure. If I write down this equation and I operate with this d alpha, then that better be zero. Okay? But this is not true. Is not equal to zero in general. And so, but there is something we've derived which is true. The Bianchi identity strictly speaking, the contracted Bianchi identity implies that d alpha of r alpha beta minus 1/2 g alpha beta times the Ricci scalar, which is the other contraction of the Riemann tensor, okay, that this is zero. So So it suggests that the original equation wasn't quite right, but if you add that correction, then it is right. It is consistent, at least. So R alpha beta minus 1/2 G alpha beta R equals kappa T alpha beta is consistent with covariant stress energy conservation. So that's good. So that seems to be a consistent equation, and all we need to do to fix the constant is work out the left-hand side and the right-hand side for a weak static field, and that'll fix the constant. So to fix the constant, consider this combination, by the way, is called the Einstein tensor. Actually, there's some debate about who pointed this out. It probably was Hilbert, mathematician Hilbert, told Einstein it was inconsistent. You better fix your left-hand side of your equation. So Einstein's pretty lucky to have his name on that tensor. And there was a whole debate about priority, who got the right version of Einstein's equation, which is interesting historically. So to fix the constant, consider weak static fields. Okay, so where we had this Poisson equation. And we'll just calculate the Riemann tensor for such a field. R sigma rho sigma mu nu for a weak static field. Okay, so I'm going to take the metric to be independent of time, and what I have in mind is that the 0, 0 component of the metric is basically minus 1 plus 2 phi over c squared, the Poisson, just the formula we had before. Now, if the field is weak and static, then the Riemann tensor, there's a nice formula which I think you looked at yesterday in the problem class, the Riemann tensor with downstairs indices just looks like this. G rho nu sigma mu minus G rho mu comma sigma nu minus G nu sigma mu rho plus G mu sigma comma nu rho plus gamma gamma terms. Okay, I think you had that in the problem class yesterday. Is that right? Yeah. So the point is, for weak static fields, gamma is of order h, right? Because the metric is eta plus h. Gamma involves derivatives of the metric. So gamma is of order h. And so these are order h squared. Okay? Because if g equals eta plus h, and this is small, then gamma is of order h, and so gamma gamma is of order h squared. And so you can neglect those if h is small. And so this expression, now it's easy to read off the components of the Riemann tensor. Obviously, R with all four indices 0 is 0, because this is antisymmetric under either the first pair or the second pair of indices. And then you get Ri 0, j, 0. Remember, I and j are spatial indices. 0 is the time index. And that's equal to minus 1/2 G00, comma, ij. Okay, let's see where that comes from. Let's see if I put these indices i0, j0, then every time I have a 0 after the derivative, I can throw the term away, because that's a d by dt, right? Comma 0 means differentiate with respect to ct. And so sigma is 0, so I can throw this away. This is this away. Nu is 0, so I can throw this away. So the only non-zero term is this one, because rho is j, and mu is I, or rho is I and mu is j, and nu and sigma are both 0. So that's the only non-zero term. And so now we can calculate the Riemann, the Ricci tensor, r 0, 0. And that's equal to r at 0, 0, 0, 0, which is 0, plus r I 0, I 0. Okay, so all I'm doing here is writing this as r alpha like that. And there are two terms, when alpha is 0 or where alpha is I. Okay. And so this term is 0, and that term is just the summation over I and j. And so this one is minus 1/2 g 0, 0. Well, it's just minus 1/2 grad squared g 0, 0. Okay, because raising an index, g ij, is equal to delta ij plus of order h. And h is small, and this term's of order h anyway, so I can ignore h squared. Yeah. Oh. So we want to calculate these components of the Riemann tensor. So rho is I, sigma is 0, mu is j, nu is 0. Okay? So if I look at this term, sigma is 0. So that means, what this means here is d2 by dx sigma dx mu, right, of g rho sigma. That's what this means. That's what this expression means, g nu sigma. Now, if sigma is 0, it means I've got a time derivative of the metric. But the metric's static, so this has to be 0. And likewise here, sigma is 0, so this is static. Here, nu is 0. And so this, again, involves a time derivative of the metric, which is 0. The only way to get something non-zero is if both the time indices are these ones, and then these are space indices, and that's not 0. Okay, so that's our 0, 0. And so now let's take our, so I've worked out r 0, 0. So let's now transform this equation. We can save ourselves a little bit of work if we transform this equation. Let's take that, let's define this as dagger. Let's contract dagger with g alpha beta. Okay, so the left-hand side is g alpha beta r alpha beta minus 1/2 g alpha beta r. And the right-hand side is kappa t alpha beta g alpha beta. And so this is just by definition, that's what R is. The Ricci scale is the contraction of the Ricci tensor. What do you think this term is? G alpha beta, G alpha beta. Pardon? It's 4. Okay, why? Because when I raise it, this is the same as delta alpha alpha. Right? The delta, Kronecker delta, but contract summed over the indices. So I get 1 for each value of the index, and I add them all up, so I get 4. So here I get r, and over there I get minus 2r from this term. And that's equal to kappa t alpha alpha. And so this tells me that r, the Ricci scalar, has to be minus kappa t alpha alpha. And so what that means is I can actually take this term to the right-hand side of the equation. And so dagger is equivalent to 2 r alpha beta equals kappa t alpha beta minus 1 half g alpha beta t lambda lambda. Okay, so I just use the fact that r is minus t. R is minus kappa t alpha alpha. So this term becomes plus 1 half g alpha beta t lambda lambda with a kappa. And then I'll just take that term and put it over here. Okay, so that's just saving us a bit of work because it's easier to calculate the Ricci tensor than the Einstein tensor. Well, we've already done it. And so now we can write R00, which is equal to minus 1 half grad squared G00 for these weak static fields, is equal to kappa. Now, T00 is rho. That's the energy density. And let's work out T lambda lambda. So here I'll need the formula for a fluid. For a fluid, we have T mu nu is equal to P G mu nu plus rho plus P U mu U nu. Was that in the homework? That was in the homework, right? That was the formula from special relativity where this was an eta. But obviously, to go to general relativity, you just make it a G, and it's still a tensor. So that's the stress energy tensor for a perfect fluid. And if P equals 0, this is non-relativistic matter. Then you can forget the P terms, and so then T mu nu is just rho mu u mu u nu. And the trace, T lambda lambda, is just rho times u squared, which is minus 1. Because G mu nu u mu u nu equals minus 1. Okay, so we get a rho from this term. And then we get a the G00 downstairs will give us a minus 1, okay? And again, to leading order in H. So remember, G is eta plus H. And I'm just going to take the eta contribution because the field is weak. So this is going to be minus a half times minus 1, the 0, 0 component, times this trace, which is minus rho. Let's put all that together. We're getting k rho, kappa rho over 2. And so here we have that del squared g naught naught is kappa rho over 2. And we had this already. We had from before, this had to equal minus 8 pi g rho over c to the fourth. Okay, so we determine here that del squared g was, sorry, before we had that this was del squared g naught naught. And so from this we can see that kappa is equal to 8 pi g over c to the fourth. Okay, so that is the argument whereby Einstein determined the Einstein equation. And are there any questions about it? Yeah.
How is to get the explanation of how this solves
the problem? Say that again.
Volume of the field propagating by mass.
Very good. So the way it will solve that is because this equation, if I work it out for real weak fields, will be roughly speaking del squared, will be roughly speaking e to alpha beta d alpha d beta h. Sorry, finding the wrong indices. H alpha beta. So when you work it out for weak fields, you will not get grad squared. Okay. So this operator, which is Lorentz invariant, you get d2 over c dt squared minus plus grad squared. Okay. So the equation for time-dependent weak fields actually involves this. It's a wave equation. And so what will happen is that when I move my mass, the h alpha beta, this correction to the metric, does not change instantly. It actually propagates as a wave. Just like in electromagnetism, the electric field, when you move a particle, the field responds, and the response moves out at the speed of light. It's exactly the same for gravitational fields. And so that brings an important point, that the prediction of this theory, Einstein's theory, is there are gravitational waves. Just again, like Maxwell. You see, Maxwell tried to make these consistent equations for currents and charges, and he had to introduce that dE dt term to make it consistent. But when he did that, he could throw away the charges and currents, and he found there was a propagating wave, and that was light. So Einstein just repeated the same thing. He said, let me make a consistent equation, and then you can throw this away. Throw away the stress energy, and there are wave solutions which move at the speed of light, and those are gravitational waves. So he literally was copying exactly what Maxwell did for electromagnetism, and with exactly the same conclusion, that there are waves which travel at the speed of light. Yes, so if you move an object suddenly, you get a kink in the field. If you move it slowly, Let's imagine instead, say in electromagnetism, I take a particle and I just oscillate it up and down. Then I get a sinusoidal wave coming out. And it'll be the same for gravity. If I take an object, like the Earth going around the Sun, it's just generating the sinusoidal gravitational wave that travels off. So you don't get a kink, but you get sinusoidal waves traveling off to infinity. These have now been experimentally measured, gravitational waves, in the following sense, not directly, but due to the binary pulsar. So binary pulsar is a pair of neutron stars which are orbiting each other. And if you take Einstein's theory, you can predict the energy being emitted in gravitational waves over time. And so this energy is emitted, and basically it causes these two neutron stars to spiral inwards slowly towards each other. So their orbit period is speeding up because they're actually getting closer to each other. And that's been measured. And for that, Taylor and Weisberg were awarded the Nobel Prize, I think, in 1997 or something like that. So that there has been observational confirmation that objects with sufficiently strong gravitational field moving at sufficiently fast velocities actually do emit gravitational waves. The next step is direct detection of the gravitational waves here on Earth. And there is an experiment called LIGO, Laser Interferometric Gravitational Observatory. And they have two detectors, one in Louisiana and one in Washington in the US. They're about to build one in Australia, I believe. And these are basically 1 kilometer arms at right angles. They bounce a laser beam backwards and forwards on the arms, and they just measure the length of the arms. And if a gravitational wave comes through, what it does is it squishes one of the arms and stretches the perpendicular one. And you should be able to see that. So there's a hope that these waves will be directly measured within the next 5 to 10 years. They're pretty close to the threshold. And when that happens, we will be able to see the mergers of black holes in the universe and other violent gravitational phenomena which emit lots of gravitational waves. So this is actually the next big window in astronomy, is detecting gravitational waves. It'll be very, very exciting. And you may know there are a couple of the sort of leading researchers in the world that are working at Perimeter on this problem. So Louis Lehner is doing simulations of black hole collisions. And somebody who's arriving in a couple of weeks' time, his name is Chad Hanna. And he is responsible on the LIGO project for the search for 100 solar mass black hole collisions. So this is going to be a very exciting theme of research. Yep.
Based all of this on local energy translation.
Yes.
So that means that locally we have time translation invariance.
Yes, that's correct.
So,
and actually, it's more than time, because the stress energy conservation includes energy and momentum, and it's a consequence of time and space translation invariance.
So, because everybody says that even though the universe is expanding, you can't see it on a local level.
That's right.
So, does it mean that they're just actually not doing anything on a local level?
Correct. Okay. So, you can always pick locally inertial coordinates, which up to order x minus a squared, physics is just special relativity, it's nothing else. So, you can always do that. And so locally, energy is always conserved.
But
globally, it's not.
But is the local conservation, like time translation invariance, is it exactly or just the order of epsilon?
Order epsilon squared.
But mathematics doesn't care about epsilon or anything. It has to be invariant.
Then the correct statement is it's not.
But how
the correct statement is that energy is only conserved up to corrections of order epsilon squared.
So if Einstein knew about this, then he couldn't have made this argument before?
No, it's a good argument. He's saying, I want an equation which is consistent, at least at leading order.
Oh.
That's all. And that's enough to fix the problem of the equation.
Okay.
Right? Just to say that at a given point,
I should be able to pick coordinates in which there is energy conservation up to epsilon squared. That's all. But you're absolutely right. The energy is not conserved. In general relativity, energy is not conserved. It's a general statement. There's no conserved energy. It's conserved up to epsilon squared in the vicinity of any point.
Here, because the region of energy and momentum is not like an integrated equation.
Yes,
locally, you have, a point, you have energy and momentum conservation.
Yes, but.
Or is it when you integrate and try to find a final point there?
Okay, so in the vicinity of any point, so we have this equation. Let's imagine I have this equation. That is not a conservation law in the usual sense, because there are Christoffel symbols here. Okay? So basically, a conservation law, a true conservation law, an exact conservation law is this. Right? Because now I can really construct an energy and momentum, and I can show that the integral over space of T naught naught is conserved, and so on. This is not true. However, this equation reduces to that in locally inertial coordinates. Coordinates, because in these coordinates, the Christoffel symbol is zero. Okay, so in the neighborhood of any point, this reduces to that. But the Christoffel symbol can only be made zero up to order epsilon, right? Because the metric could be made equal to eta up to order epsilon squared. So the Christoffel symbol is the first derivative of the metric that can only be made zero up to order epsilon. At order epsilon, you get the Riemann tensor. So the first derivative of the Christoffel symbol cannot be made zero. So basically, this is saying this equation is true plus order x minus a corrections. Okay, so it's a very subtle thing. If I want to construct a conserved energy, I've got to pick some region, and then I sort of decide what accuracy am I working to. I'm expanding in x minus a over some length scale. You've got to expand in a dimensionless number. No expansion makes any sense unless what you're expanding in is dimensionless. So it's always x minus a over some length scale. So if the gravitational field is smooth on some length scale, I go up to some order, and then I say within that volume, I can integrate my stress energy to get an energy, and that'll be conserved. But it's kind of tension between two things. To make an energy, I must integrate. But I don't want to make the integral too big. Otherwise, it goes beyond the validity of the expansion. So there's always this tension. But providing you're happy to work in this approximation, it works out. Yeah.
If you came up with some experiment to measure the energy conservation or non-conservation, would it show in the real world that energy is conserved or not?
It will definitely show it's not conserved.
Right.
And we've already done the experiment. Because in cosmology, one of the consequences of energy non-conservation is that a photon has its wavelength redshifted. So the energy in a photon definitely decreases over time as the universe expands. Now locally, it's again a very subtle thing. Locally, I can pick coordinates such that as I watch this photon going past, I won't see that up to order epsilon. Okay? You can pick coordinates which effectively factor out the expansion of the universe at the point you're living at. However, globally, the energy is going down. Okay? Let me see. I just lost my train. Okay. So we've seen this experimentally, because what you do is you have this molecule called cyanogen. Have you heard of this? So the redshifting of light was actually observed before the Big Bang theory was confirmed. It was in the 50s. What people noticed is that they looked at these cyanogen clouds. It's a complicated organic molecule, but it has some spectral lines. And cyanogen is excited by a particular frequency of light. And so you look at these very distant cyanogen clouds, and you see emission. And the emission tells you
that there was incident radiation on these molecules of a certain frequency, just the right frequency to excite this level. And the but the problem is that the corresponding frequency corresponds to radiation at 10 degrees Kelvin, not at 2.7 degrees Kelvin. Okay, so the universe has these clouds. They're actually very distant clouds, which are emitting light, which was caused by the fact that the microwave background radiation at that time was at 10 degrees, not 2.7 degrees. This was actually observed in the 50s. It was an anomaly that all the molecular astrophysicists were very strange, a cyanogen cloud is emitting due to some radiation, which is actually at 10 degrees. And that was the cosmic microwave background radiation. And the fact, and then later in the 60s, it was measured to be at 2.7 degrees Kelvin. But from these two observations, you could tell that between now, when we're measuring the radiation, and then, the temperature of the radiation has decreased from 10 to 2.7. So it's observationally verified that photons lose their energy as the universe expands. And this is a global effect. I mean, it's not. It's an example of the violation of stress energy conservation because, you know, photons move as fast as anything. Nothing can go faster. So if you want to see some violation of stress energy conservation, you know, over a large scale, look at a photon. It will be the best chance of seeing it. Yeah?
So the non-conservation of energy in the whole universe is a local phenomenon.
It's a global phenomenon. Okay, so in the neighborhood of any space-time point, I can choose coordinates in which this violation is of order epsilon. But bear in mind, those coordinates are only valid at a certain region of space and a certain region of time. So they're not going to capture cosmological evolution. Cosmological evolution is over a long time.
But I think about, I mean, trying to go to a limit, and from one point it's coming out energy.
No, it's a global phenomenon. It's global. I mean, this is maybe another manifestation, but in gravity, there's some characteristics of gravity which are global. So the principle, the equivalence principle, which Einstein used as a guide, is that gravity locally, in a little part of space-time, should be irrelevant to the laws of physics. Okay. But globally, it's definitely not irrelevant. And in fact, it causes violation of energy conservation. Yeah.
It's probably for Steve, but if you take a local area that's large enough to observe, like, I don't know, to order 3 perturbations and things, then would you then see energy non-conservation in a local area?
Say
my local system is big enough to get to these clouds you were talking about earlier, and then energy isn't conserved in that local system.
That's right.
But it's locally conserved, so that's a contradiction.
No, it's not, because it's conserved up to order epsilon. Okay? Where epsilon is the size of the region.
Right, so in this local system, then energy isn't conserved completely.
Well, it's not local.
Why is it not local?
Saying it's local means that it's conserved up to order epsilon, where epsilon is the size of the region. If you make the size sufficiently big, you will see the violation of energy conservation. I'm afraid I have to go because there's a faculty meeting. So we'll continue
tomorrow. Yeah. Could you talk about, in the previous lecture, you brought up the metric isn't symmetric. You brought up in another lecture that the metric's not symmetric. Yeah, you brought up that the metric can be separated into symmetric and non-symmetric. It's caused a bit of confusion, especially in the science, where people are not assuming symmetric.
Ignore all of my statements about the metric and non-symmetric.
Last today is in the bistro as well.